Well, hello, everyone. We have a monstrously special guest today, like gigantic. I'm fanboying a bit right now because
just a little bit. Yeah.
This person is a member of one of my all-time favorite bands, and also he plays Telecasters like crazy, so he has to be amazing, you know. So, Chris Shiflett Chris Shiflett, his own music, and the Foo Fighters, and also your podcast. You have an amazing podcast called Walking the Floor.
Yeah.
I listened to the Brad Paisley stuff several times over and over because I'm a nut for Brad Paisley.
Sure.
And of course, the Vince Gill one was one of my favorite episodes that you did.
Yep.
So
yes.
Yeah, I love that podcast, man. I listen to it quite a bit when I'm breadboarding, actually.
Well, thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. You know, I've been kind of on hiatus with it most of this year. And I've actually been working on, I will give you a scoop, I've been working on a new podcast idea. I don't even know if I'm going to go back to Walking the Floor. I probably will at some point. But I've got a whole new, more guitar-centric idea that I think is going to come together. So
cool.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah.
For awesome. All you guitar players out there.
Well, there I have to say, too, yeah, I think I've show. Listened to the Merle Haggard interview, I don't know.
Oh, yes,
like
that's right.
12
a couple of
times, yeah. Probably. I absolutely, it's one of my favorite interviews, period, that I've heard, let alone with like one of my heroes, obviously. So
yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah, thank
that's
you. Right. I mean, that was a really wild experience because to me, Merle was the tippy top of the tippy top of, you know, the greatest country singers, greatest country songwriter. I mean, just greatest songwriter, singer, regardless of genre. For me, he's just the absolute. And it's funny when anytime people say like, "What was your favorite interview?" I always refer to that one because it just came out of thin air too. I got back from tour. We had been like in like Asia or something. I came back from a long flight and told the guy, my buddy Davis, that was helping me at that time, like, "Don't book anything this week. I'm burnt. I need to just chill out at home." And he calls me back later that day and goes, "Hey, Merle Haggard's publicist said we could interview him tomorrow in Bakersfield." I was like, "Pack up the van, baby, let's go."
I found some energy. There it is. Yep.
And you know, sadly, he passed away not too long after that. So I don't know for a fact, but I kind of think that was probably his last kind of long form interview. You know, I don't know. I've never seen one. Another one from around that time. So, and he was so cool. He was just like open to talking about whatever, you know. I wish I had a little better sound quality for that. I didn't quite have my mobile podcasting rig together, but so you get a lot of that, like, bus. Anybody that's ever toured on a bus knows that constant hum of the air conditioner because we were sitting on his bus, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but it is what it is. At least I got some hang time, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would
I've
be
done
amazing.
A couple of the bus interviews, and I don't know, for me, like, obviously the quality is less than what we're used to, but there's something about, for somebody like me who doesn't spend a lot of time on buses, the vibe, you know, the whole, you know, everything running, people coming in and out, like,
sure.
I don't know, it just adds some realism and coolness to the whole thing. I like the bus interviews.
Well, you're basically going into their house, you know what I mean? So it's a more intimate setting for the person you're interviewing, for sure.
Mm-hmm. They can be relaxed and in their element, so to speak.
Yeah.
And if you're not used to being on buses, like, I don't know if you are, Blake, but I know my first time of being on a bus was kind of surreal. I was just like, "Holy shit, I'm on their bus. This is strange."
Yeah,
I mean,
oh,
I've gotten used to it since then, but being in the business, but doing a podcast in that sort of scenario, I would think would kind of be a little bit, give me kind of the jitters a little bit.
Well, you know, I think for like most musician people, it's like you sort of spend your whole childhood or your teenage years, young adult years, dreaming about getting to the bus tour. And then when you finally get it, you know, if you're lucky enough to get it, it's sweet. You know, I remember the first bus tour I ever did. I was in a band called No Use for a Name, and it was the first year of the Warped Tour, and we were on this bus where it was us, and we didn't have a big crew, but a few crew people with us, and then L7 and their crew, and then like that was already a full bus, you know what I mean? But they managed to jam like a few like inline skaters on there too. Just like every inch of space on the bus was covered. And it's funny because at the time I really didn't know Jack Diddley about country music. You know, I was a lot younger then. And And our bus driver was this grumpy old dude that had, I want to say he had been like Ray Price's driver, something like that. Something wow. that now I would be like, oh my God, tell me stories. But at the time I was like, fuck this old fucking asshole. He's always grumpy. He would like hide my shoes when I pass out, you know, and stuff like that. Wake up in the morning, I'd have no shoes. I'd have to go walk around. Like they'd be like under the bus. I'd have walked to go get catering barefoot. You know what I mean? It was just like, we were like at war with the bus driver. But I didn't care because I was on a bus. And it didn't matter that it was like stinky and overcrowded and people everywhere. I was just like, yeah, I'm on a bus, man.
Mm-hmm. I reckon this is why you're getting yourself a trailer, Bri. I reckon you want to live the bus life forever.
Oh, camper.
I think your camper is basically you getting yourself on tour now for the rest of your life.
Are you going van life? Hashtag van life.
Off-grid completely.
I wish I could.
Nice.
I wish I could. It's hard to take all the guitars and pedals and stuff with me, though. Camper.
You can fit a lot in a Sprinter, my friend. You can fit a lot in there.
That's what I'm working on.
You're just going to strap the family to the roof. You can fit lots of guitars in there.
That's right.
Yeah. Just put them in a different car entirely.
Exactly.
There you go.
Going in a different direction.
Yeah.
You need a second Sprinter, and then you can even, your family and more guitars. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, just pull a trailer with everything. That would work.
So you mentioned something I wanted to get into because I wanted to ask you, like, you seem to have really dove into country in the last, I don't know what the time frame is, 8 to 10 years, I would guess. I've been following you for a while. I was a No Use for a Name fan, of course, you know, back in the day. And the Warped Tour was my, you know, coming of age years. So that was a big deal for me.
He's so young.
So, you young buck, come here. We're gonna take you in and mentor you.
Oh, yeah, that's what I need is more mentoring from these two guys. That's what I need. Yeah. But when did you start getting into country? Because you've gotten really passionate about it. That's very apparent.
It's kind of a roundabout thing, you know. I mean, I always liked old rock and roll. I liked old music. I was always just drawn to old everything, you know, like old TV shows, whatever, you know. But I grew up with a love of like Elvis and you know, early Beatles and Stones and all that stuff, and all the old rockabilly stuff from the 50s, you know. I just always dug that. And of course, when you get into like Sun Records, you get into Johnny Cash and all the stuff that was like, you know, either country or one step removed from it, and it's all pretty, you know, related, the early rock and roll and like the honky tonk of that era. So little by little, you know, it was just kind of there in some ways. Patsy, like I remember I had like Patsy Cline greatest hits, and you know, when I was a teenager, and you know, maybe a couple Johnny Cash greatest hits or something like that, but it wasn't really something that I knew. And then when I was in, it was actually when I was in No Use, the singer from No Use turned me on to a lot of the alt country stuff of that era. And mm-hmm. that was kind of the jump off point for me. And it was like Uncle Tupelo and Sun Volt and Wilco and all that, like into Steve Earle and Lucinda Williams. And then you just keep kind of going further back and further back. And I just, you know, it's one of those things when you get into something kind of after the fact, it's like there's so much out there. You can never really even digest it all. I mean, I don't feel like I've gone through in various ways at various times, probably all the eras of sort of, you know, if we're looking at sort of modern country from the 40s on, you know, I've listened to it all, but I haven't come anywhere near listening to it all, you know,
like, right.
You know, cause there's just so much, it's just an endless, endless ocean of music. But yeah, it was really probably in the last 8 or 10 years or so that I started making records that, where that influence was showing through more. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's, you know, it's not what I grew up with. I grew up listening to rock and roll music and heavy metal and stuff like that. But it's all related. There's so much overlap. It's all the
good
same
music
stuff.
Is
it's
good music, right?
Yeah. It's all like 12 bar blues progressions. And it's just kind of depends on how much you're hanging on that, you know, the flat third to the third or what, you know what I mean? Like right. All those little things that there's so much overlap in it, you know?
There, you're right. There's like 8 different songs.
Yeah.
It's just a million different ways to do them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm seven songs short. I'm screwed here.
Damn. There's eight different songs, and then there's Pink Floyd. How about that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
whoa. Yeah. Shots fired. Yeah.
Take a shot.
Just kidding. Oh, yeah. Right, so let's for the listeners, can we kind of dive back into how you got to here?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, how far back do you want to go?
Well, I mean, let's say, you know, you're teenage Chris and you got your guitar and you're listening to Shout at the Devil or whatever. What's going on?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So I always say that I had older brothers, you know, and I was really lucky to have older brothers who liked really good music and had great record collections. And so for most of the first part of my life, I didn't even really have my own opinions or my own record collection. I just had their record collection, and whatever they thought was cool, I thought was cool. You know what I mean? And so, you know, it was like all the stuff that I meant, just all the classic rock stuff. You know, we grew up in the 70s and the 80s. So all the classic rock stuff. And then like somewhere around like junior high, high school, started getting turned on to punk rock. You know, the punk rock of that time. And sort of, you know, as music changed so much, from the time that I was, say, in junior high, you know, I was really into like heavy metal and stuff. And then I discovered this band called Hanoi Rocks in eighth grade, sort of at the end of their thing. And that was like, just the world went Technicolor when I got Two Steps from the Move. It was like this abrupt musical left turn into some other thing. And it was like right around that time that was kind of like their influence had kind of started this whole scene in LA of like Guns N' Roses and Faster Pussycat and Elegant. All those bands were kind of popping up. So I kind of went from listening to like Keel and Armored Saint to like this hard, like, no, I'm only into Jet Boy and Hanoi Rocks thing and Johnny Thunders and the New York Dolls and all that. And that kind of dovetailed with like really older punk rock. And then as you go on through the 80s, you know, there's a moment where Bad Religion put out Suffer that was really musically to me that was like another one of those like, okay, everything was going this way, now we're going this way kind of moments. And that led to like NOFX and Pennywise and then the explosion of like Lagwagon and No Use for a Name and Good Riddance and all those bands. So that's kind of, you know, as we went into the 90s, I was listening to a lot of that stuff and then ultimately participating in you know, being in No Use for a Name and you know that late 80s early 90s stuff, but there was all that great stuff coming out of the UK too, like Stone Roses and Blur and, you know,
you're talking about. Let me just tell you right now, you may as well start speaking Swahili because I've been trying to educate them for a while and I've failed, Chris.
I was really into that stuff, you know, like everything from like the early Prodigy stuff to like Primal Scream and Charlatans. And I went to see all those bands when they came through LA. I moved to LA in like 1990 and things had changed so much from the LA that I grew up going to. Was very different than the LA that I moved to, you know, and musically things and alt rock was about to explode. And then a few years later, you had the Green Day and the Offspring, all that, you know, it's just things were just seemed like it was just evolving so fast and you had to kind of keep pace with it. And you sort of, you know, when you're young, you want to keep pace with it. It's exciting, new sounds and new stuff. And, you know, and you totally disregard the thing that you were into a year ago. And that was lame. I was never into that. And here's this new thing. And I was always into that. And, you know, all that stuff. But I think those years for the 80s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, it was just great, great times for music. A lot of good songs and vibes in those days. I mean, there still is. There always is. But that's, you know, you're sort of more, that's, those are the years that kind of influence what you do.
We'll be right back.
Is real music dying? What even is real music? And who are we to judge that? Well, my father is a lifelong musician, and together we've been making music for over a decade. In our new podcast, we dare to ask the urgent, the weird, and the deep questions, and we have a lot of wild stories to tell. No matter what genres you enjoy, whether you're a musician, a producer, or a listener, we invite you to discover unconventional perspectives on music. So tune in, and go follow Mad Makings of Music wherever you listen to podcasts.
Right.
yeah, some people say that you get, a lot of people get stuck in those years, not those specific years, but those ages. And yeah, I didn't really understand that until recently when I'm like, oh, I'm nostalgic for 2002. That's weird. That's really weird.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I never thought that
is
would
weird
happen.
Though, Blake, to be fair, that what came out in 2002?
Because everybody knows that 1989 was way better, son.
Oh, yes.
You know, I think about that with my own kids all the time. I have three boys. And yeah, someday they will look at, Denzel Curry the way I look at Motley Crue. You know what I mean? It'll be that thing that they go, oh man, when I was 13, that sounded so good.
So you also have a guitar with Fender.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how'd that come about?
Well, that came about because I had assembled a couple Warmoth parts guitars. Really, if you go back a little further, I had gotten like a, I think it's a 72 Tele Deluxe, you know, with the wide range pickups in it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I loved it. And I played that a lot for around the time I made the very first Dead Peasants record. And it really sounds great for that kind of, you know, playing. I mean, it sounds great through anything, but playing it through like a Vox or a Fender combo, you know, Fender Deluxe reverb or something like that just works really good. But it was not quite crunchy enough for Foo Fighters. So I wanted to make basically the same guitar, but with humbuckers. So I did that with just some parts guitars, and Fender saw that, and I even put like a fake Fender logo on it that I think it said my name or whatever, but kind of bit the Fender logo. So, and they didn't sue me. They offered me my own signature model. So, which was super fun. Cause then we got to like kind of take what I had made with those parts guitars and refine it a little further and make it way better. And we put that out years ago, and then eventually, and the first one that we did, the main one is like kind of try to keep the price down, and then we also made one that's like the most expensive guitar ever made. That's like pull out all the stops, all the bells and whistles. Right. I think we sold three of them, but we knew that going into it because it's like, you know, it's the opposite of what the main one was.
Yeah.
Did you ever get into like any stuff with, since you like Telly so much, did you ever get into like anything with benders? Like T benders, B benders?
Oh, B benders. Yeah, no, yeah. I bought the Fender, you know, official B bender years ago with the original, what's his name? Gene.
Parsons? You know, Parsons?
Yes, with his like patented B bender mechanism. But then somebody told me about the mod. What's the guy's name out in Nashville?
Glazer?
Mm-hmm. The Glazer mod. Mm-hmm. So somebody told me about the Glazer mod, and I had this. I was in Nashville years ago, and had this Tele that was like, you know, fine American made Tele, but you know, brand new, nothing special. Wasn't like a particularly high end one or anything. And I didn't like the paint job on it, and I'd gotten it painted like Pepto-Bismol pink. And I took it and I thought, oh, I'll get the glazer mod on this, you know, and took it in there, and the guy opened the case and looked at it, and he's just like, you sure you want to do that, man? on this? Like, which I took to mean like, why do you want to spend the money on this piece of shit? You know, was how I interpreted that. But I did it anyway, and it's awesome. It's such a good mod. It's so light. It's like it's not, you don't even notice there's no extra weight to your guitar at all. It just works so good. Yeah. It's nice. I love the B bender. I put it on things here and there, but I have never, I don't think ever played it live because I'm just afraid of it. I tend to wiggle around when I'm playing live, and that thing's like jerking all over the place and like going a half step out of tune. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like to play that thing effectively, you'd have to A, be really confident, and B, stand perfectly still. Although I probably should just throw it in the set and get used to it.
Well,
you know,
I will tell you, there's a screw on it. If you tighten it all the way, then your bending action is really tight.
Ah,
and it's pretty good. It's pretty good about jumping around and not actually bending the string at that point.
Okay. I'm always, it's one of those things that like, like knowing when to throw it in. It always takes me a minute. If I'm trying to put it on something, I got to really work it out. I'm not like second nature with it.
Right. You're thinking around chords, I imagine.
Right. And you also, I have that thing of like, well, I can't just do the bend up to the major third. It's so obvious. So you're trying to find like the flat seven and you know, right, all that stuff, you know, and that's where you start getting into trouble when you're thinking about it too much.
So, I mean, obviously your rigs from food to your personal stuff, obviously those are completely different rigs.
So they're maybe pretty different. Yeah.
Maybe we can kind of start with foo and then move to and talk about this, your own stuff and
how they do influence each other. I mean, they're a lot of, there's, you know, especially like pedals and things tend to, you know, there's some overlap there.
Ooh, pedals.
Especially lately. But my Foo Fighter rig for the last several years has been, amp-wise, it's been A-ing between Friedman Brown Eyes, which I have, now I'm running in stereo. So I have two 412s, and then the Friedman Brown Eye, and then an AC30 also going through two 412s. And I sort of set the AC30 with like a, you know, like a Mike Campbell-y jangle grit. Mm-hmm. And then the Friedman is more the high gain, you know,
right,
rock, you know, if you're playing Monkey Wrench or Everlong or something like that, you know, it's
right,
that kind of thing.
So no metal zones or anything like that. Okay. Gotcha.
Not yet. and then guitar wise, you know, I play the master built version of my signature guitar a lot. And I generally those come in red, but they made me one in like a Sherwood Forest green. Yeah. And for whatever reason, it's just certain guitars, just you just kind of have a connection with them. And that one I really have probably played the most and lean on the most. And I tend to go between that and I have like an old 57 gold top that somebody took the paint off at some point in its life. And those are, you know, live, those are the mostly what I've been playing through.
What about pedal wise? Like, what do you? I mean, obviously, you probably don't have a lot of dirt and stuff, but you may run some delays and reverbs, I imagine.
Yeah, there's a lot on there. You know, I it's funny. I just did finally. It's not out yet, but I just did a one of those rig rundowns the other day, just a couple days ago, and we got in there, and I realized like, wow, I should have probably like looked at my pedal board and thought this through a little more because I'm like sitting here trying to remember like why I put this on there and what the hell does that little thing do? You know what I mean? Like, is that something my tech put on there that I don't even know why? So I have a bunch of pedals and I've been messing around with stereo delays lately. And so, I got on that from a guy that I was doing some work with was noticed I had one of those Strymon Decos at my studio. And he goes, oh, you ever do that thing where you set it so that it's like the wet, dry tape thing? I was like, huh? No, I didn't even know that was the thing. And he showed me and it's like the greatest sound I was like, how did I not know this thing did this? It's so incredible. So I have that going with not only the sort of the wet, dry, thing that I don't even have set. You can set it like at a slap or even kind of a almost wide delay, but I have it almost just straight down the, you know, right on top of each other. So it's just mm-hmm. like tonally doing this weird trippy kind of chorus, little bit of chorus thing. And I have the tape saturation set about halfway up. So just kind of another little extra bit of grit on it. Mm-hmm. And then that goes into the Strymon timelines. And I've been messing around with like the dual delays on there. So you get a little bit of that like back and forth ping pongy wide stuff for something like, you know, like times like these or something, you know, it's nice when it's got that little spacey, it's kind of bouncing around stereo right. thing. And then other things on there, I have an EP boost. I have one of those KTR Klons, which I usually put, I don't really ever put anything overdrive wise in front of the Friedman's, but I will put that in front of the Vox from time to time.
Just hit a little harder, I guess.
Yeah. And also I have one of those Muffalettas on there, the JHS Muffaletta.
Yep.
And that I will either put in front of the Vox or I'll put the Brown Eye on the clean channel because it's got a really nice clean channel. And the big muff sound through the clean channel is pretty great. And then I got just, you know, a Boss Chorus, MXR Flanger, Phase 90. You know, those are like, I use all those a lot, especially the flange and the phase. I have the phase set at like 9 o'clock. So it's just kind of that slow, almost Waylon-esque, you know, kind of thing. But it's just in there. It's just kind of slowly the waves going. and I put that, I'm a sucker for all those flangey, phasery kind of effects.
Yeah. So your own stuff, I mean, obviously it's a completely, I wouldn't say completely, but it's quite a bit different than what you would expect with the Foos. So it's, I'm not even sure how to really classify it. I would say kind of traditional kind of country infused with rock in a way that's not bro country.
Yeah, it's like, it's like country rock, you know, you know, kind of like it's, cause I certainly, am influenced a lot by both, you know, but like, I always say I'm not good enough to play straight up country. You know what I mean? Like I haven't gotten there yet. Still working on my Brent Mason licks, but I'm going to get there one of these days, kids. But yeah, I'm probably tonally, I mean, the biggest difference is the amps. Most of the time in my solo thing over the last several years, I'm either playing through like a Princeton Reverb or a Deluxe Reverb. But the overlap has been since I started messing around with that Deco, I put that on my board and I've been rocking it with with two Deluxes, rocking them in stereo, also with the Timeline. So same kind of thing, you know, that wide tape thing with some ping pongy delays here and there. And then, but for tone wise, I usually put those up around like 4. So, you know, at about 4, the Deluxe is breaking up a little bit, but it's not like crazy. And then I'll put like a red snapper in front of it with the gain pretty rolled off, but it just gives it a little extra hair for like rhythms where it's not too hairy and it's not overpowering. And then I'll put the EP boost on top of that when I want to play a lead. And I don't even have it really, I don't even have that cranked up too much, but just a little extra hair, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah,
we could definitely
phasers and flangers and all that stuff.
Gotcha. What'd you say, Richard?
I said we could definitely all do with some extra hair right now, Brian. Just gonna say that.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
We totally should send you a Metaverse multi delay, which is one of our more recent pedals, because it's got. Again, for me, I'm astounded that more people aren't as jaw-droppingly in love with it as me, because it has like a flanged analog delay on it, which A, frees up my flanger for other duties, but B, it's just the most gorgeous stereo sort of swirling sound, and you can get lost in that. If you mix that with some of the other pedals you're talking about, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. So I think that needs to be on the list.
Send
there,
away. I'm happy to do some R&D.
Extended R&D, that's our job.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever tried I think Boss makes one, and a few other people do too, but a panning tremolo when you're in a stereo rig, where it's not really ping-ponging, it's more just like sweeping, and you get this sweeping effect between the two. It blows my mind like every single time. I set the amps as far apart as I can and let it just pan in between, and I feel like I'm in a movie or something. It's the craziest.
No, I get it. That sounds amazing. You know what? And you guys might be just the people to talk to here. This is the weirdest thing, and this could just be my own sort of ignorance at operating the machinery, but I cannot for the life of me figure out how to make, and I've mucked around with like every delay pedal that I've got that has a stereo option. I can't figure out, I would like to make a pedal, or I would like to suggest to pedal makers such as yourselves to make a pedal. That just is a delay that goes hard stereo in quarter notes and dissipates at the same time on each side. So you go, I can't make my delays do that. They all go like,
I know that feeling.
And there's like some bizarre calculus inside to set it to a dotted eight and this and all that. I just want it to go on a quarter note. Bang. Bang, right, left, right, left. Why doesn't anybody make that?
You know what, Chris? I actually can write, me and my guys can actually write that specifically for you and put it in the Metaverse.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God, yeah. Please save me.
That's the good thing about knowing a person that, you know, does pedals is you can be like, yes. Hey, can you just make me this?
Yeah. That's the sound I hear in my head, but I haven't been able to figure out how to work that out. So that would actually be amazing. We should do that.
I think I got you, fam, is what my kids say.
So, yeah.
I mean, it is pretty difficult to kind of just dial that in using settings, though. I was just thinking that through. I could probably do it easily with two delays. You know, if you were doing two delays and sort of splitting the stereo, you could do something there. But that's actually not a bad shout, because that's a more useful use of like a ping-pongy delay than your kind of standard boom, boom, boom straight across. If it was just the trails kind of alternating out in, as you say, quarter notes or eighth notes or whatever you set it at, that could make some really interesting effects, actually.
Yeah, it'd be neat.
We don't pay a consultancy fee, just going to let you know that. We're real cheapskates.
No way, I won't. I'm not. Hey, you heard it here first. I'm just a consumer here, putting it in the suggestion box.
Well, we'll definitely pay you with a pedal or two. There's a
I'll take it.
Brian knows a thing or two about country music tone. I think that's safe to say. But what I was going to ask you is probably, you know, the question that every one of our listeners wants to know, which is, given a choice in your ultimate Arsenal 11, would it be Henri, Bergkamp, or would you maybe even take Gabriel Jesus in today?
Well, that is a really good question. You mean like I have to pick one of them?
One from, like, at their peak, you know?
Right.
I'll even throw Ian Wright in as well, because he is a legend. Brian's glazing over now. He's like, what is he talking about?
I saw your strip there, and I was wondering when we were going to get to this conversation, and I'm glad we did.
It's a good time to be a goober.
Me too. Me and Brian are so excited that we got to this conversation.
Yeah. Well, keep it going. I'm going to use the restroom. I'll be right back.
The real question is, what sort of boost setting does Thierry Henry have on his pedal board? But we can get to that later. it is the interesting thing. Like I always wonder that with sport and athletes, you know, would somebody from another era, even though like Thierry Henry was not that long ago and neither was Bergkamp, but how would they slot in now? Could they just step into it and be as effective, and would they be as good and as legendary? I mean, I guess it's sort of like not a real question, because they would have come up in this era, and so they would have adapted their game. And so I don't know. I mean, you have to go with Thierry Henry out of that selection. But Jesus is like, come on. He's the guy right now. He's the man. The hero.
I mean, we've got this guy playing for Man City. I don't know how much you've been following the current Premier League, but Erling Haaland is like a robot. He is unbeatable. But the wife and I are both huge gooners. I had, in a previous life, we had a corporate box at the Emirates, which was awesome. And I had a season ticket for a few seasons. But we went once, and it was, I think it was 99, and we got lost at Highbury. We were walking around like, how do we get out of here? And I literally just walked into a room, and Thierry Henry walked at me and bumped into me, and I was like, I'm not normally lost for words, but you, sir, are a legend. And look, I mean, I can't explain to you guys how big Thierry Henry was for Arsenal, but I had a Thierry Henry shirt, and when he retired from the club, it never got worn again. And then he rejoined us for a season, and I put that on, and I was the happiest guy. He is an absolute, like, the biggest footballer I've ever seen play. I mean, I loved Bergkamp, don't get me wrong. I love Wrighty, but Thierry Henry, for me, absolutely the best player we've ever had. And, I miss that guy, I'm just going to say.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I feel really lucky that I got to go to some games at Highbury back in the day. So I did get to see Arsenal in that period. I wish I had a clearer memory of them. I was usually pretty hammered at those things. I went through this where I was on this great podcast called Life Goals, where you have to like pick a bunch of goals that were like meaningful goals in games over the course of your life. And I literally sat with my friend who took me to those games, And we couldn't remember between us which games we had been to or what had happened in any of them. I didn't remember who we played, who scored, anything. So I had to just make a bunch of stuff up. But yeah, I know what you mean. I went to a fundraiser at the Emirates a few years back before COVID. And it was at that period where it was like Giroud and Sanchez mm-hmm. and Rosicki was still there. And, you know, right. it was, you know, Per Mertesacker and all these guys. And it was the most bizarre thing to be in a room with all those people walking around, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, you're just I almost bumped into Sanchez coming out of the bathroom and just like, you know, my eyes went wide and I did, oh my God. Huh? And I can tell you, like, whoa, dude, hey, easy.
We were really lucky.
They're larger than life, you know?
Yeah, we had this corporate box, and one year as a gift, I mean, corporate boxes were like $100,000 a piece. So as a gift, they said to us, would you like, you know, four people to come to a training day? So I was like, yes, we absolutely would. And I got me and three of my mates at work. We went along and we went to London Colney where, you know, we had Ian Wright sort of showing us around. Arsene Wenger was training the guys. Mikel Arteta was the captain. Per Mertesacker was towering over me. He is huge. I mean, Vieira was huge, but Mertesacker was massive. And I think that's next to the birth of my daughter and the gig I went to this last weekend, probably one of the greatest days of my life. And I couldn't ask Arsene Wenger anything. I just stood there looking at him. I was like, yeah. You, sir, are a god amongst men. Right. That's my football talk done, Brian. you're clear.
I was going to say, that's...
I was going to say, what about the day that Brian asked you to be on this podcast? That doesn't rank. What's going on,
best
man?
Best days, we were saying. Right? Not
that's behind
days.
Arsene Wenger. Come on.
All right.
To listen to you guys discuss that, it reminds me of myself, like, going backstage at concerts. Like, oh, my God, I'm back here.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing that happens when you've been in this business for a long time. That's how I used to feel going backstage at gigs. Now I feel like, oh, I don't want to go back there. I'm annoying them. They're trying to like relax to before they go on stage. I know they don't want me in their dressing room, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that I'm an annoyance. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we all are. Yes.
No, that's awesome, man.
I did want to ask you, you know, speaking of like, going backstage and then like, you know, Richard fanboying and all this stuff. You've had to experience like several different levels of that, right? Back when you were doing the Warped Tour circuit, obviously that was big for the time. But then when you're in Foo Fighters, that's a different thing. So like,
sure.
Was that transition weird at all, or was it nice training wheels leading up to it?
It was very weird. Yeah, it was great. I mean, being in No Use, was awesome to go do a bunch of touring and, you know, the basic fundamentals of touring are the same at any level. You know, you got to make it to lobby call. You can't be a dick in the van. You got to, you know, don't fuck up the show. You got to, you know, like, don't get hammered before you get on stage or whatever, you know, maybe for a lot of people do get hammered before you get, but whatever the sort of the particulars of your band, you right. have to sort of figure out where you land and all that and be a team player and all that sort of stuff. So, by the time I joined the Foo Fighters, I was like used to that and loved that. I loved the dynamic of touring. It was like my favorite thing in the world. But joining the Foo Fighters was obviously on such a whole different level and a lot more of it and a lot more all throughout the day with, you know, going out and doing promo and all the stuff that sort of goes along with it. So it was radical, but I was so stoked that I was just eyes wide open, just taking it all in, you know?
Mm-hmm. And what did your, this is because this is supposedly like a gear show. This is like the most gear centric we've been in like months.
We're all on our best behavior. That's why.
I will tell you, my gear has changed a lot. Over
that's
the
exactly
years.
Where I was going to go with it. Like, what did that used to look like?
Well, so when I was first playing in bands, I didn't have an amp. So I used my brother's amp. My older brother, Mike, had, I don't know why he bought this. It's kind of funny because he was he wasn't in a band or anything at the time, and was never really, he's a great guitar player, he's a guitar teacher nowadays, but he never was really like active in playing in bands much. But he bought a Music Man full stack. Ooh. And so by a few years later, when I came along and started playing in bands in high school, I just grabbed his Music Man and would take that and play with it for years. And then when I was in the year before I moved to LA, I got, my mom made me get a job and I was working and I saved up some money and bought my first amp that I went and bought with my own money, which I still have, which was a Mesa Boogie Mark III.
Oh, wow.
And you know, this was 1989, dude. That was the amp. And it was a big tonal change from that Music Man, you know? And that was my amp for years. That was the amp that I played in all the early No Use for a Name tours. Somewhere in the middle of being a No Use for a Name, I bought a dual rectifier. And Mesa Boogie was really so intertwined with that, with like punk rock at that time. You know, everybody was playing through a boogie, through a dual rectifier, triple rectifier, whatever. And they were really a cool company. Like I remember they would always like, cause I was living in San Francisco and they were up in Petaluma, and anytime you needed help with anything, you could just drive up there and they'd fix your amp for you. And you know, they're really great, like really supportive of all the bands and stuff. And so that was my main amp when I joined Foos. Somewhere along the lines, I remember I got a Rode King. Do you remember those things? I think it had like four channels.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do like a really wide range. You could have one be crystal clear, one be kind of voxy, one be, you know, gain but not great, and then one be like crazy tone. You know what I mean? So like I played that thing for years up until I switched. I don't remember exactly. I think at one point I just went straight AC-30. I think I was just playing an AC-30 in Foos, and we used to just dime that thing and just have it super crunchy. Mm-hmm. And then I got the Friedman around, I want to say maybe Wasting Light era was when I got the Friedman. Mm-hmm. I remember because we were rehearsing at Mates. I don't know if you've been out to Mates in North Hollywood, but it's like a rehearsal studio out here that's like everybody, you know, over the years. Like that's where I actually auditioned for the Foo Fighters. And it used to be where we rehearsed all the time before we had our own studio. And Dave Friedman's shop is like right across the street from there. And I remember my tech going like, oh man, you got to check out these amps that this dude makes over here. And I walked over there and I plugged into it and I was just like, I'll take six of these. And there was no looking back. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the Friedman is much more of a Marshall-y type of gain. It's not that super saturated, modern boogie style gain. So, I love it. It's definitely, that type of gain is way less forgiving, but it's more sort of classic rocky, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Dave definitely knows his onions when it comes to amplifiers, doesn't he, Bri? I had a problem.
I'm a bit jealous of Dave in that way, because like he's in the mecca of where things happen, right? I'm in Indiana.
You told me that was the mecca. Well, you told me that was the center of the USA. Yeah. Hold on.
It might technically be.
Yeah,
geographically
it is.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, bro, I remember that one time I had a problem with a Soldano. It was a tube in my amp, but I didn't know what the problem was. So I was like, so obviously, you know, Soldano is one of the companies we work with. So, you know, I rang up the guys there and they were like, oh, it could be this, could be that. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure it is. Let me ask Bri. He knows a thing or two. And he was like, could be that. Why don't you try Dave? I'm like, which Dave? He's like, Friedman. I'm like, sure, why not? So I texted Dave, and actually Dave was the one who got it right over the phone. I'm like, how cool is this? I'm getting like personal amp tech for my little bedroom rig from Dave Friedman. So he's a very, very nice guy. We're doing some work on his website at the moment, actually, but he's a very funny, very cool guy.
Wait, where in Indiana are you, Brian?
So if you know where Bloomington is, I'm in between Bloomington and Indianapolis, right in the middle of the woods. So there's nothing around me, but nice. Which is good and bad. But you guys were going to be here last year, I think. Is it this summer, actually? So unfortunately.
Maybe, not, yeah.
Didn't happen,
yeah.
But maybe in the future. Who knows?
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, when we come through Indy, man, come out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Man, my head is spinning, to be honest with you, Chris.
It's too much coffee again, Bri. I've told you, stay off the coffee in the afternoon. It does you no favors.
Jeez. So, I want to kind of play a clip. I want to actually play a clip of your
not
song
kind
Born
of.
And Raised. Not kind yeah. of. I want to actually do it. Because, like, when I heard it, I'm like, this is a really effing good song. Like, it's...
Oh, thank you.
I mean, it was just like... It was completely different than what I expected in a good way.
Oh, you know? Right on. Right on.
Yeah, I mean, just like, it's good songwriting, I guess.
Thank
is what
you.
I mean. Like, it's really
mm-hmm.
good.
So thank you.
Let me play a little clip of it for those listening here. Then you kind of go into a little baritone part there.
Yes, and I'm baritone. Like, you knew it was a baritone.
He's playing baritone ooh. On there. Yeah. Hell yeah,
I love
man.
The baritone.
You know, it's funny, you know, like you talk about like influences and stuff. I was totally in my head thinking, be cool to do something like that Dwight Yoakam song, Little Ways, because it's got that cool baritone stuff in there, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind of rattling in my head. Like, how do we get that kind of honky tonk baritone sound on it? Mm-hmm. The problem with putting a baritone guitar solo on your record is then you're like, well, now do I have to take a baritone on tour with me?
For that one song, right?
Yeah, for that one song. Yeah.
I think the same thing when I have to play a regular guitar. I'm like, oh, you mean now I have to bring a regular guitar, not just a baritone? What's going on?
Yeah.
This is nonsense. I knew, as soon as I heard that lick, Brian, when I listened to it before we obviously did this, and I was like, oh, Brian's going to love that part.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I was like, oh, he's going to love that.
Yeah, I mean, and the steel on it, like, it's kind of, like, that's what I was trying to say earlier. It's kind of, it's country-ish, but it's not, if a person turns on country radio right now, it's not like the bro thing, which I personally love.
Sure.
Like, it feels like it's legitimately kind of going back to the roots while still coming up with something newer and modern, if that makes sense.
Oh, right on. Yeah, I mean, I recorded it out in Nashville, and it was a great bunch of players playing on it. Luke Schneider plays that steel on there, and he's great. And yeah, it was fun, you know, like that's kind of in a nutshell, I guess what I'm usually trying to do with my solo stuff is find that kind of balance of, you know, it sits in the middle of country and rock and roll, you know. And like, I feel like when I first started putting out records kind of like that, like, I don't know why. Maybe I was just more influenced by like that sort of mopey minor key kind of stuff. And little by little, as I would go out and play shows, I just kind of like, I realized like you want to play stuff that you want to have songs that are fun to go play in a room full of people, you know, that are get people kind of tapping their toes and having a good time and knocking a few drinks back. And yeah, so. That's always kind of a little bit of an... I mean, the other song I put out a couple months ago is a total mopey minor key bummer, so I don't know what I'm talking about.
Ah, now it's talking my language. Hold on. Right. I can talk here.
Yeah. Every time I write one of those songs, I'm like, God damn it, another mopey Americana song. Jesus.
Well, if there's one thing the world needs, it's more mopey Americana songs. There's not very many of those written out there. One question about your process on that. So for me, like, I've found that I've kind of had to just go with the flow in order to write anything. I used to try to like, I'm going to write this kind of song, and it just never really worked for me. Were you able to just like have stuff pour out of you, or did you have to be intentional when you go to write something?
No, I kind of went through that. There was a point, it's funny, songwriting is such a weird thing, right? You know, like, nobody can ever exactly explaining even their own process with it. But there was a point years ago, like probably, I don't even know how long, 15 years ago or something, I always wrote songs and just kind of like wrote lyrics as an afterthought. And well, you got to have a vocal. So I just kind of like, you know, write some shit, but never really spent a lot of time thinking about the lyrical side much until I took this songwriting workshop with a songwriter named Peter Case, who you might remember from his solo stuff, or he was in the Plimsolls years ago. A great songwriter, and it was cool. And I just took it like I was home, and I thought, you know, this, when can I sit in a room with Peter Case and pick his brain about songwriting, you know? And I loved it so much that I did it actually I took it again not too long after that. Because basically what he was teaching was like a creative writing workshop, but in context of songs, you know? But it was a lot of the same ideas.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I ever really thought about like, you know, is your chorus supported by your verse and that sort of thing? Like, is there a overarching story here? And, you know, what are you trying to say with this? And so that was really helpful and really fundamentally changed my approach to songwriting. But it also fucked me up for a while because I was thinking about it too much instead of just writing. So it is that constant thing of like, you want to just write, you get an idea, just write it down and see where it leads you and all that stuff. You don't have to be so purposeful with it. But once you've done that, for me, what I like to like kind of like, you know, edit and revise it. And I love writing with other people because that always puts a totally different spin on whatever your idea is. And over the course of the years of doing my podcast, I've interviewed so many great songwriters, and so many of them have said things like, oh, you know, you write the hook line and then write backwards from just like little things like that I never really thought about. And I remember one time interviewing, I think it was Whitey Morgan. He said, man, I could just write verses all day. If I don't start with a chorus, I never finish. You know, like I got to start with a chorus and then write the verse, because otherwise I'm just going to write 800 verses and never have something that sums it all up, you know?
That sounds like my songwriting up to this.
Yeah.
One verse and that's all I got.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, that's so it's always evolving. It's always changing. But I do like to, you know, revise more than I used to, and think it through a little bit more, and think about how the words sing and all that sort of stuff.
Do you feel like that songwriting workshop kind of changed your approach to working with Foo as well?
Probably, because it's got, everything's kind of interrelated. You know, I'm not the songwriter in the Foo Fighters, so
right.
But as far as like, you know, when we're sitting around wood shedding ideas and stuff, sure. Right. I think, you know, just as far as song structure and all that kind of stuff, it definitely influenced how I kind of hear things and see things.
Right.
So you definitely got some great, great shows on your podcast, but the one that really immediately leapt out of me was Suggs from Madness.
Yes.
Who is
how
always,
great was he? Did you listen to that one?
I did
so
listen to
great.
It. He's always fantastic, but this was and guys, I know neither of you are Madness fans. You should be. You need to go and check it out because he was brilliant. It was like, I mean, I don't think he let you get many words in edgeways, to be fair, Chris. He was kind of like me. He just kept talking and you couldn't stop him.
But that's what you want, right?
It's exactly what you want. And he was brilliant. And like, I love listening to it. And I kind of got the feeling that you had a little bit more of a British kind of punk and ska grounding than I'd known about, because obviously we're talking a little bit about it. And then you mentioned one of my favorite rock star autobiographies, which is Johnny Lydon's No Blacks, No Dogs, No Irish, which its day was an absolute, like, for me, revelation. Because, I mean, he's an Arsenal fan too, so that's fantastic.
Well, that's why I'm an Arsenal fan.
Because that book?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I never heard of Arsenal until I read that book. And I read that book.
Such
a good
book.
That's who I'd be throwing my, you know, I'm throwing in with those guys.
Oh, well, John Lydon's done something good in his life. So, you know,
that's great.
He's got you up to Arsenal.
Well, you know what's funny is that era of punk rock, like British, the British punk rock was actually really kind of what I got into first. I mean, it's sort of like when I started really listening to punk rock, there were sort of two eras that I was listening to. And one was like the Pistols and the Clash and the Damned and Stiff Little Fingers and all that stuff. Which was and it would have been like 8 or 10 years after the fact. So it was like not current anymore, but that was the punk rock. Like when I was in high school, that was the stuff that I really connected to, and the Jam and stuff like that. But then it was also the mostly like the West Coast stuff that had happened a few years earlier as well, like TSOL, Descendants, Social Distortion, you know, all that kind of stuff. But all those bands were over by the time I discovered them, you know?
Oh, same. But they so still like, impacted.
It still impacted. So they were a huge influence. And then, you know, from the British stuff, then you get into all the two-tone stuff. It's like, you know, it just kind of keeps going, the tentacles of it. But yeah, no, that music, that style of music, that style of punk rock and rock and roll was huge, huge influence on me.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, the first time I heard Nevermind the Bollocks, it was like that life-changing moment where I was like, you can put music out like this? Like, I'd never heard anything so angry and so pointed and, you know, intelligent. And also, it was three chords and a crashy drum beat. I was like, this changed my worldview. And like you, I mean, I kind of got into that when I was probably 12, 13. So we're looking at kind of mid to late 80s. And yeah. I then immediately gravitated to like Suicidal Tendencies and Faith No More, and then towards Thrash and Anthrax and Metallica and bands like that. Sure. And it was just all from that one springboard. But there was something in the water in Britain between, I guess, 77 and 81, because it's such a creative period. The punk, the post-punk was just, you know, I hear it in music today. And
that's one of the things that was so cool about talking about interviewing Suggs was I love talking to guys like him that were there for all that. Like he hadn't come to, like Madness hadn't become a thing until a little bit after that. You know, really, when you look back,
but
now,
he was still
it seems
working
like it was all about
it.
The same time, but it was but it was two different things. You know what I mean? And so, like, you know, like those guys like him that, and it's interesting because so much of the 80s music were like, even like guys like Duran Duran and stuff that you wouldn't associate with it were like young kids listening to that wave of punk rock. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Were influenced by that. It's wild.
Mm. I mean, in the 80s, like, it would be laughable to say that you love Duran Duran. And I unashamedly do love Duran Duran. I'm not going to lie. And, you know, that kind of electro pop that, you know, was kind of laughable back then was so original compared to kind of some of the stuff that sort of followed. So, yeah, I'm totally there for the early British wave, and I'm just trying to get Brian into it. But he can't get past the accent. He's like, I can't understand what they're singing about. There's no trucks. Yeah. There's no fishing.
Brian, I'm
going to
make you a playlist.
I was a huge Black Flag fan, and I listened to quite a bit of TSOL as a kid as well. I was a big skater.
There you go.
So.
Oh, there you go. Nice. Yeah.
So, Chris, I know you got to head off here. So I really, really appreciate you spending some time with us today. If people want to find you, like, what's the best place?
I mean, probably the best place is my Instagram account, Shifty71. I do have a website, but it's like chrisshiflettmusic.com. But like, does anybody look at that anymore? I don't know. Probably not. Probably just social media. Look for me on TikTok, kids.
Oh, really? You're on TikTok?
I make TikTok videos now, and my 14-year-old is my harshest critic. I haven't, according to my son, I haven't quite figured that out yet, but I'm working on it.
My daughter, who's just a little bit older, says the same thing about me. So
I resemble that comment, too.
Yes.
So big thanks to Bill Bays, Jake Young from Man the Helm Podcast, Justin Burke, David Tindall, Nighthoss, Dave Trombetti, Shannon Weaver and the band Reduced to Rust, Eric Wilson, Vidar Frostad, Michael Freer, Sean Arbo of Gun Street Wiring, Rick Calhoun of Honeypicks, DJ Patty F, Dylan Talks Tone, Strand, Kevin Harrington, Barry from Grez Guitars, Felicity who makes the annoying memes, Tom Kelly, Pigsy, Zebo, John O'Neill, Robert Carr, Hunter Hudson, Rob Stokes, Jordan from Poison Noises, and the Flying Dutchman. All right. Hang tight, Chris, and to everyone else, we'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Chasing Tone podcast. As always, if you have any comments, questions, or concerns, you can email podcast@wamplerpedals.com, and I'll personally get your email. To email Blake, email info@tonemob.com, and Richard can be reached at richard@wamplerpedals.com. If you'd like to show your support for the show, the simplest and free way to do that is to share this podcast with a friend, leave a review and a rating wherever you normally get your podcasts, and also check out Blake's podcast called The Tone Mob. Make sure to check out WamplerPedals.com for blogs, videos, and of course, guitar effects. If you'd like to hear the post-podcast conversations and to get even more content, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/chasingtonepodcast. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.